Today is June 13th, 2018. Do you know who has your personal data? Let me ask the question differently. Do you know who is using your personal data? Welcome to the Personal Computer Show. This is the original personal computer radio show of all things computing. I'm Hank Key and my colleague is Joe King. Podcasts of the program is available on wbai.org/archive. It's available on prn.fm and on our website, pcradioshow.org. We are on WBAI-FM 99.5 on the radio and prn.fm on the internet each Wednesday with essentially the same program, except when WBAI is in a membership drive, the programs are slightly different. AT&T is once again raising the prices of its grandfathered unlimited data plan, up from $40 to $45 for anyone who's managed to still hold on to the one that they had since AT&T discontinued the original $30 unlimited plan back in 2010. This marks the third time that AT&T has raised the price for grandfathered unlimited customers in the last decade, first to $35 back in 2015. They raised it again to $40 last year, and now it's $45. While the slowly increasing price tag is certainly onerous to you, if you happen to have a grandfather plan, you're still paying far less than any of the current unlimited plans that AT&T have. AT&T explained that the cost increases is due to the fact that customers are using mobile data at record levels, and the trend is expected to continue. To help make sure that they continue to provide the best service for all of their customers, a small price increase is being made at this time. The cheapest unlimited plan that AT&T currently offers is $65 per month. It has always been the concern that a big company can cut their prices so that the little company that they're competing against cannot compete price-wise. Well, that's not the true in the case of Sprint. Sprint is offering an unlimited plan for $15, and that wasn't a typo. Sprint can't compete with Verizon and AT&T on network coverage or exclusive devices, but it always had the advantage of being dirt cheap. Sprint is offering, with a new deal, they're now offering unlimited data, calling, and texting for $15 a line. Things just went up a notch. Of course, there's one big catch to that. You have to be porting in each line from another carrier to qualify. Sorry, existing Sprint customers need not try to qualify. Here we go again. Facebook has been dominating the computer news with one misstep after another. A Facebook bug made private posts of 14 million users public. The bug was active from May 18th to May 27th and changed users' privacy settings without them knowing about it. The company said the problem has been fixed and Facebook will notify the 14 million users who could have been affected. About 14 million Facebook users who thought they were posting a message just to friends or smaller groups may have actually been sharing it widely with the general public due to a software bug. A Facebook user typically defaults to a pre-selected privacy setting. However, a bug that was active from May 18th to May 27th changed posts to automatically be public. The posts were clearly marked as public, but users who were used to their privacy settings could have easily overlooked the public designation. The company said, "We'd like to apologize for this mistake." That was said by the chief privacy officer, Erin Egan. "Hey, I got a note to Facebook. We like to apologize is in a subjective voice. The tone of we like to apologize is very different from we apologize. If you're truly sincere, don't use a subjective voice." And to make matters worse, you would think that the younger teenage audience would be the next group of followers on Facebook. No, they're shunning Facebook. 95% of teens have access to a smartphone, and 40% of teens are almost constantly online. But younger internet users do not connect on Facebook as much as their older peers do. In a study released recently by Pew Research Center, although Facebook dominated social media across all age groups over the past decade, it has taken a backseat to YouTube, Instagram, and Snapchat among today's teens. A whopping 85% of them reported actively using YouTube, 72% said they regularly use Instagram, and 69% were on Snapchat. As of which of the social media services the teen survey participants used the most, Snapchat came in the highest, with 35% identifying it as their most frequent choice, while YouTube followed at 32% and Instagram at 15%. Facebook was a distant fourth, with just a 10% of respondents identifying it as a service they use most often. Teen social media habits have changed since 2015, when Pew conducted its last survey on the topic. Just 24% of teens went online, almost constantly, essentially half the number that do so today. A large proportion of teens have moved away from Facebook to embrace the other services. They felt it was too open and gravitated towards Snapchat. To them, it felt like a safer platform where anything they put in writing or photos would vanish in 20 seconds. The young teens also gravitated towards Pinterest, but only briefly, as Instagram replaced most other options. The changing taste of younger social media users are consistent with teen behavior in general. They seldom stick with what the previous generation liked in music, fashion, or other pop culture trends. They don't know that Instagram is owned by Facebook. With social media, though, there could be other factors explain what is driving them away from Facebook. They don't want fake news, political nonsense, motivational themes, or advertising or spam. That's why they don't do email either. Teens will always share and stay connected with their own tribe, yet they will only do it in a private, protected environment. There is a race in supercomputers as to which system can execute the most floating point instructions per second. You also have a race as to which computer processor executes the greatest number of floating point instructions per second. These two statements sound very similar, but they are very different. We have been conditioned to think that a supercomputer is one fast system. A supercomputer that computes at lightning speed a large number of floating point instructions per second. The inference in all this is a super-fast computer. In reality, the supercomputer of today is having the ability to incorporate into the design the greatest number of processors in that computer processing system box. The aggregate of all the CPUs then becomes the measure of the system's number of floating-point instructions. But taking the execution of a single task, then it is the measure of the fastest CPU in the system. If you have an application that can operate with more than one task at the same time, then it's the total time it takes to process that application, and that really is then the real operating or execution time of the application. In the case of a supercomputer, it consists of thousands of computer processors integrated into a single computer system. If the application can only perform a task sequentially, of course, the time to complete the task then is measured by how many floating point operations can be performed by one single processor. It matters not that there are other processors available, but you can't take advantage of it. At the consumer level, the applications are almost always single task operating sequentially. There are exceptions to that, where certain applications do take advantage of more than one processors if it's available. So where are we going in all this differentiation? There was a recent headline proclaiming that the world's fastest supercomputer is back in America, having the ability to execute the greatest number of floating point operations does not mean that you have the fastest computer. If a given program has not been designed in which the application can execute more than one operation at a time and it can only operate serially, well, it's not necessarily become the fastest computer. Last week, the U.S. Department of Energy and IBM unveiled a system called Summit, America's latest supercomputer, which is expected to bring the title of the world's most powerful computer back to America from China, which currently holds the mantle with their supercomputer called Sunway Taihu Light Supercomputer. With a peak performance of 200 petaflops, or 200,000 trillion calculations per second, Summit more than doubles the top speed of Taolu Light, which operate 93 petaflops. Summit is also capable of over 3 billion mixed precision calculations per second, or 3.3 exaops, and more than 10 petaflops of memory, which has allowed researchers to run the world's first exascale scientific calculation. It sounds like a mumble-jumble of a whole lot of numbers, and it probably costs a whole lot of money. It costs $200 million for this supercomputer, and it's called the IBM AC922 system, using 4,608 computer servers containing two 22-core IBM Power9 processors, six NVIDIA Tesla V100 graphics processing units each. Summit is also relatively energy efficient, drawing just 13 megawatts of power compared to 15 megawatts the Chinese Taolu Light pulls in. The Financial Times reports that the European Union antitrust investigation into Android is concluding and a fine is expected to be announced in July. The European Commission has been investigating Android after rivals complained that Google has been abusing its market dominance in software that runs on smartphones. Google has been accused of limiting access to the Google Play Store unless phone makers also bundle Google Search and Chrome apps, a practice that may have breached European Union's antitrust rules. Google has also reportedly blocked phone makers from creating devices that run fork versions of Android as part of an anti-fragmentation agreement. A fine is reportedly expected next month, but it's not clear how big it will be. The European Union could fine Google $11 billion. 10% of Alphabet's, that's Google's parent company, annual turnover. However, that's unlikely that Google would be hit with an $11 billion fine, but it may be over $2.7 billion, and that would set a new record. Google was previously hit with such an amount last year by European Commission for breaking antitrust laws. The European Union accused Google of demoting rivals and unfairly promoting its own services in search results relating to shopping. Microsoft had a similar fight with the EU more than 10 years ago when Microsoft was accused of bundling its Windows Media Player with Windows, and EU forced Microsoft to unbundle the app so that competitors could get a fair advantage. Well, Microsoft created a special version of Windows for Europe without the app, but it was the European Union's next ruling that really hurt the company. Microsoft was also accused of bundling IE, the browser, with Windows, and EU forced Microsoft to include a browser ballot with non-Microsoft browser in an effort to improve competition. We've been asked by many, how does one break into the field of IT or information technology? Formal education is not really required, but it has become almost an absolute requirement to gain access to that first job interview for information technology. The cost of earning a degree in the field of computer science can create a heavy student loan debt burden. Marty Winston and I talk about the value of a college education, as well as other possible alternatives. The importance of having a college degree in information technology. As long as employers insist that a college degree is necessary, it will continue to be a requirement. If you're someone who can get into college, going is practically a no-brainer. Those who go to college make more money and have more opportunities than those who don't. But saying that college is important is different from saying that it is important in theory. There's currently a big demand for college graduates. The cost of earning a college degree is, quite expensive. Imagine if employers, no matter what business they're in, begin believing that college degrees are valuable. Careers that traditionally favored college degrees now consider them mandatory, and some that never sought a degree suddenly begin seeking college graduates. That leads young adults to see a college education as more and more vital as they want to be competitive in the labor market. So as a college education cost rises, they take on more and more student loans to ensure that they get a degree through government-guaranteed financing. To be sure, there are some trades where a college-level education is absolutely necessary. Engineering comes to mind. Some graduate-level degrees are also necessary in careers like law and medicine, but most college majors have little application requirements in the workforce. A required college degree becomes a non-controversial de facto requirement. So why is there demand for education if it's not necessary? Because employers do want smart employees. It can be suggested that the situation would be better if employers didn't face potential lawsuits for conducting aptitude tests. Without that option, they instead must rely on college as a gauge of ability. Conducting aptitude tests would certainly be better than forcing people time and money of college if it's unnecessary. Is employment testing legal? Yeah, the answer is yes, but it must be qualified. Employment testing is legal as long as a professionally developed employment test is administered according to the test developer's intended use. It isn't that the test is legal or the application of the test that makes the difference. An aptitude test is one type of employment test. It's testing an applicant's knowledge of a particular subject that pertains to the job for which they are being considered is perfectly legal and, when applied properly, can be a valuable hiring tool. Be sure to consider the following, however, before administering any aptitude or IQ test. Make sure the test has been professionally developed. Make sure all questions on the test are applicable to the job. And all applicants and employees for the job description, even within those who are employed with you, have been given the same test. With many private college educations exceeding, well over $100,000 these days as total cost, that's a pretty expensive means for identifying adequate intelligence. Unfortunately, this may describe all a college degree has become. There was a time when a high school degree served this purpose. But when high school standards declined and college became more popular, some applicants stood out above others as being more educated and potentially smarter than those with only a high school diploma. As the value of college degrees fall to be worth as little high school degrees are today, so many applicants will have them that if this trend keeps up forever, perhaps one day we'll have locksmiths with PhDs. Well, what percentage of high school graduates go to college? According to the Bureau of Labor Statistics last October, just 65.9% of people who had graduated from high school the previous spring. The National Student Clearinghouse, which tracks more than just first-time students, found the six-year graduation rate for students was 60.5% at public four-year colleges and 62.5% at private nonprofit colleges. Well, what percent of college students graduate with a debt? 66% of graduates from public colleges had student loans. 75% of graduates from private nonprofit colleges had student loans. 88% of graduates from for-profit colleges had student loans. Average debt levels for all graduating seniors with student loans rose to about $30,000. That's a 25% increase from about $23,500 in 2008. What is the average time to pay off a student loan? The standard repayment plan for the federal student loan puts borrowers on a 10-year track to pay off their debt, but research has shown that many have far exceeded the 10-year period, and both research has shown that the average bachelor degree holder takes about 21 years to pay off this loan. College is expensive, and student loans can take years to repay. So it makes sense to study a subject that will quite literally pay off in the long run. Equally important, it helps to know which majors are likely to lead to a fat paycheck and there's reasonably ample employment opportunities. College is often considered the surest path to a lucrative career. After all, according to the U.S. Labor Statistics, a worker with a bachelor's degree typically earns 2/3 more than someone with just a high school degree. But not all college degrees are created equal. Increasingly, students want to understand the career and income opportunities associated with their college education. Clippinger did a study recently where they analyzed data for 126 popular college majors to determine which majors typically come with the best hiring prospects and pay. They look for courses of study that tend to lead to fat paychecks, both right out of school and further along their career path. They also sought out majors that are in high demand based on recent online job posting, as well as long-term growth expectations for related occupations. And they also factor in the percentage of workers with given degrees who feel their jobs have a positive impact on the world because of a sense of purpose and can be just as important as having a good payday. Well, here they are. College majors with the worst rankings. Well, let me just take the first five. In other words, starting from the worst to maybe the fifth worst. Culinary arts, followed by photography, art, paralegal studies, and anthropology. The opportunities for getting a job afterwards is very low. What about the college majors that will give you the best opportunity for getting a job? Well, let me list them. Civil engineering, biomedical engineering, nursing, computer science, information security, management information systems, finance and economics, software and engineering, aerospace engineering, actuary mathematics, in that sequence from the best to, well, the top 10. So is a college degree in a field of study in information technology a must? No, it's not, but it is definitely an almost absolute requirement if you're going to be employed or you want to be considered for employment. There are rare cases, and they are rare, where a college education was not required to be very successful. Witness Bill Gates and Steve Jobs.
Hank isn't the first to notice that universities are revenue engines, that they fill seats because they collect tuitions, and that tuitions help them buy the things they like to have. Well, yeah, sure, it's a business, but they're not your only option when it comes to learning whatever you decide to learn, whether it's electronics, IT, or anything else. And four-year universities certainly are not your only option. There are two-year colleges that may be helpful. There are technical colleges that may be helpful. Trade schools are kind of iffy. You know, some of them are there more for the money than what you might learn. You might do better, you know, picking up a comic book. So you want to be an IT tech. You know, that might be better. Don't want to make any overly broad statements, but there are some I simply don't trust. There are others where I've heard good things. I'm not sure any of us can tell which is which, just at arm's length. Trade schools are just a little weird, but there's one place to learn a trade that is extremely effective, that doesn't charge you a penny. In fact, they pay you money to go there, and they give you a contract the first day you show them any interest. And that's the military. If you want to learn how to do IT in the military, see a recruiter. See what they can do to teach you. If you have a degree, you might go as an officer. Going as an officer is an option, not a requirement, and you may want to take a look at being an enlisted man initially, and if you stay around, a non-commissioned officer eventually, but you know, that's the military. There's something else you can do. This doesn't sound obvious. Get a job. The cable companies, really hurting for anybody with any kind of technology aptitude, any kind of talent for it, a real interest in it, and they will largely train you. And as they train you, you have the ability to be upwardly mobile, to get trained for more and more intricate, involved tasks. As they learn to trust you, as you learn to trust yourself, you can get promoted. The phone companies, same thing to a lesser extent. The contractors who just do installations, I'm not sure that's quite as attractive. It's in the cable companies where you can transfer from being the guy out there in the field who makes sure that the cable is working just fine, or the guy who makes sure it reaches the box down the street. Same company does that, as has the racks and racks and racks of gear where they're just forwarding programming like data. That's what cable companies do. So cable companies, kind of interesting. There are IT operations all over the place that don't start with you knowing how to program a thing. They start with you running wires, testing wires, with little things that make it easy. Plug this one in here, plug that one in there. Oh, look, you don't have any bad red lights. That could be that easy. They will train you to what they need. They need an extra pair of hands and an extra pair of eyes. And again, the more you do it, the more you understand what you're doing, and the more you can extend what you're doing. There's something else. I don't know if anybody who would think of being educated will think of this. This is really old school, gang. But there's reading. You can learn for yourself. There are tons of books out there, and you don't have to buy any of them. The library has a pretty good selection. Got your library card? You know, it doesn't have to cost you anything if you remember not to let them get overdue. What are you going to read? You're going to read about a programming language? You know, programming is not all that hard. Basic, Pascal, very easy to get into. And let me point out, if you've got a computer, you've got what you need to get started. Word has Visual Basic for Applications built in. So does Excel. So do other Office applications. You can learn Visual Basic for Applications, and from there you can learn Visual Basic. There are free distributions of the Python language, including some that will run on your PC. Python, the same language you can run on a $35 Raspberry Pi. You don't have to work a lot of extra shifts to afford that. Python, like Basic, is an interpretive language. It is a procedural language. You know, it's kind of a lot of, well, if this is the case and that is the case, then do this or else do that. You can do a lot with that. I send out a weekly bulletin using essentially a custom Visual Basic program on top of Microsoft Access. It's not hard. In fact, I shortcut it a little bit, save some time, by also writing Visual Basic for Application routines that happen in Word. One, to clone my issue so I've got my next issue master document ready. Well, I have one to work on that becomes the weekly issue, and then a pre-press routine that gets the weekly issue ready to send with the access routine. Does that sound complicated? Well, it kind of is, but once you're through it, then it kind of isn't. It turns into a button to push, and buttons to push are the surface of what you're trying to get underneath. They're not a bad place to start, they're a bad place to finish. How do things work? Do you know the importance of knowing how things work? Do you have a car? Do you know that if it starts acting stodgy, if it pulls every time that you want to turn, if it's not running as quickly as it used to, you could be, short several pounds of air in one or more of your tires? Do you know how that works? Do you know how the engine works? Do you know what gunk does to your engine? Not changing the oil? Do you know the other... Computers are just like that. Computers are just things that work. You want to understand them, just try to understand them. You don't understand it the first time you look at it. Hey, you have a browser? Can you ask a question in a browser? Can you go to a wiki? You want to look at the online versions of some of the books that are free? You want to go to the library? Yeah, you know what? Learning could be a little bit of work. You might have to miss a few episodes of Game of Thrones or Westworld or whatever it takes your nights away. You might have to get behind the crowd on the new release of Fallout, but it's your future. You want to be known as the best guy in Fallout? You want to be known as the guy who understands every episode of Game of Thrones? Or you want to be the guy who's got the new car because he makes more money? Yeah, motivated? That's what it's about. It's not about whether the university teaches a course. It's not about whether you spend 4 years sitting in a classroom and get checked off so you get a degree at the end. Do you really know anything with a degree? Have any of you seen the play Avenue Q? Are you familiar with the song, What Do You Get with a BA in English? Well, the same thing with computer. Same thing with information technology. What do you really want to know how to do? You want to know how to wire networks? You mean you don't already? You want to know how to terminate the RJ45 for an Ethernet connection? That might take you, 20 minutes. Do you want to know how to program? I already told you how to do that. You can go to a university and spend 4 years learning that, and it might cost you less than $100,000. You can go to a good two-year college or technical college. You might get out for, $15,000, $20,000, $30,000. Are you less employable, more employable? It depends where you are and where you're applying. You can get a job. Money goes the other way. You get paid. You apply yourself. You get promoted. Or that big, huge, effective technical training institution, the U.S. military, will be delighted to talk to you about a job. For the first years you're there, it's not the highest paying, but they'll make sure you got a place to sleep and plenty to eat. You'll make friends, and you'll learn a lot. Is that what you're after? You after learning, or you after having a degree? Are you looking for a paycheck, or are you looking for a fraternity to join? What are you looking for, and who's paying for it? Watch the money flow. What's smarter, making money for 2 years, learning more, having a good job when you get out, or paying money for 2 years, learning less, and doing what you can to get a job when you get out? I wasn't born knowing how to make a cybernetic house. In fact, that little bit of inspiration just came to me last year. But I never stopped learning. I never stopped reading books. I just finished probably 3 dozen books total on the C++ language, on programming in MySQL, on the Linux command line. That's only a start. I had to look up component spec sheets on several dozen components. I had to go take a look at the thermal differences between kinds of walls in buildings. And the more you know, the more you're curious. And the more you're curious, the more you seek out what you need to know. And when you finally find it, then you can move on to something else and learn that too. That's what it's all about. Education is about moving yourself and your skills forward. It's the one place where Hank won't tell you and I won't tell you to back up, back up, back up.
Now you can search for jobs directly on Google. In addition to turning up search results on things like movies and flights and almost everything else you want to know, now you can check for job openings. To job hunt on Google, just use the words like work, that's W-O-R-K, or job, J-O-B, plus the field or profession you're interested in. This will give you a related results in your location since Google knows where you are communicating from. For example, I searched the following, photographer space jobs, and Google showed me a whole bunch of related job openings in the New York area. Dr. Alfred Poor has some exciting news for us in wearable and health technologies. Pharma firm explores breath biomarkers to guide asthma and COPD treatment. He also covers artificial intelligence engine outperforms human dermatologist in diagnosing skin cancer. And finally, he's going to talk about a smart watch design that can display a touchscreen on your forearm.
Hello, this is Alfred Poor with news about wearables and digital health technology from Health Tech Insider.
Chronic lung disease is a problem worldwide. According to one report, there's over 334 million people who suffer from asthma, and another 251 million have chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, that's COPD. And these cost billions of dollars a year. And one of the problems is we are struggling to find out what's the most effective treatments for different people with these different conditions. Well, AstraZeneca is one of the multinational global pharmaceutical companies, and they're turning to precision medicine in order to come up with the most effective treatment for people with these lung diseases. They've signed an agreement with a company called Alstone Medical. And what this company does is they have breathalyzer technology, where they can sample breath samples and detect different biomarker chemicals in the breath. So more than just bad breath, it can detect other chemicals that will serve as predictors for different kinds of disease and different varieties of the disease. So hopefully this can point towards different treatments to respond to those different varieties that will be more effective and lower costs and produce better outcomes. So this is just one more example of how big data is going to transform healthcare around the world as we gather more information about different diseases and individual bodies and how they differ so that we can create targeted treatments that are more effective and produce better outcomes. There's a saying, give a kid a hammer and the whole world looks like a nail. Well, when it comes to technology these days, it seems as if artificial intelligence is the hammer. People are turning to artificial intelligence, machine learning, neural networks as a means of solving all kinds of problems, not just healthcare, but other problems as well. There's a lot of very interesting research that's being done using artificial intelligence to solve some of these healthcare problems. One of the most interesting reports that's come out recently is a study that was focusing on melanoma, skin cancer. This is a major problem. The American Cancer Society predicts that more than 90,000 new cases will be diagnosed each year. The problem is that it's tricky to diagnose the presence or absence of skin cancer just looking at the lesions, the bumps or discolorations that you get on your skin. A study performed by Stanford used 100,000 different images of skin cancer. They used this to train a neural network, an artificial intelligence engine, if you will, to teach it how to classify the different images, whether or not they were cancerous. And the interesting thing is that they then used the same test image set with a bunch of dermatologists. Some were skilled practitioners, some were beginners, some were experts in the field. And it turned out that just looking at the images, the doctors averaged about 87% accuracy. Now, when they got more information about the patient's history, that score went up from about 87% to almost 89% accurate. The human doctors are doing a pretty good job. However, the artificial intelligence system that was looking at just the images without the benefit of the rest of the patient's medical history, it was 95% accurate. So it was much more accurate than the human doctors, even though it was using less information. So there's more study required for this kind of research. We need bigger samples and we need to test it more broadly. But the fact is that there's so much information required to make these kinds of judgments for diagnosing many different kinds of diseases, such as skin cancer. And it may well be that computers can hold a lot more information in their head at one time, if you will, than even the best human can. And so it may well be that these artificial intelligence engines are going to become extremely valuable tools to assist doctors in making diagnoses of different kinds of disease going forward. Let's face it, smartwatches are cool, but their screens are tiny, and the cases aren't very big either. So how are you going to control a smartwatch? How are you going to input information? How are you going to give it commands? Well, people have tried buttons and dials, they've tried touchscreens, but the touchscreen is tiny. It's very difficult to interact with these things. So how are we going to interact with our wearables and give them commands and change settings and so forth? Well, a bunch of researchers at Carnegie Mellon in their Futures Interface Group, they've developed a project that they call the Luma Watch, and it's kind of cool. It has a Pico projector, a tiny miniature projector that's incorporated right into the edge of the case. And this projector can show an image that's projected across the skin of your forearm. Rather than just have it distorted by the shape of your skin and the curvature of your arm, it's actually able to adjust the image to rescale it so that it creates a proper aspect ratio image on your skin. So that's much easier to read, much easier to interact with. It also has a row of one-dimensional sensors that can actually track the two-dimensional movement of a finger touching your skin. You could press virtual buttons, you could slide a virtual slider, you can draw a shape, and it can track the movement of your finger in two dimensions. So it can give you all the kinds of input options that you would normally have with a touchscreen, except here the touchscreen is projected onto your arm. The researchers say that it gives them roughly 40 times as much touchscreen area as you would get with a typical smartwatch. So that's a lot more real estate to be able to work with. The other cool things about this project is that it's also got all the processing power needed to perform all these tasks. You don't have to hook it up to a smartphone. You don't have to tether it to some computer. It has all the processing power required on board to do the rescaling of the images so that they show up square on your arm, even though your arm is curved. It does all the processing required to track the touches of the finger on your skin. So it's able to do a whole lot all with onboard computing power. So this is it's a laboratory project, but it's a bellwether that shows other ways that we may be able to interact with our wearable devices in the future, making them much more convenient and much more natural to interact with.
For more information, go to healthtechinsider.com. This is Alfred Poor. Thanks for listening.
Thank you, Alfred. Not that you needed any reminders. Marty Winston reminds us that June 17th, this coming Sunday, is Father's Day. Would your father like to see home automation at his house? Or is that why he had you? Marty Winston talks about things you can help make things happen very simply and why your dad will be happy you didn't try to turn him into an elder Greek.
Well, Father's Day is just ahead, and since you can't yet buy him a cybernetic house, you've been thinking about something to relieve Dad of some of the household chores. Or is that something he expects from you, not out of something you give him? Ah, the continuing mysteries of fatherhood, where there's all too often a thin wall between intention and contention. So, what do you want to get him? One of those personal assistant, talk-to-it-and-it-talks-back gizmos? If he wanted one, he'd probably have it by now. A smart thermostat that lets him set vacation modes. That's like asking to be scolded for wasting your money on something he doesn't really need. Don't try talking him into it either. A generation ago, he might have bought his father a calculator or a camera or a clock radio or a watch, but those things are already inside his older, comparatively dumb smartphone, and he doesn't want another one, thank you very much. He probably wouldn't think of a toaster or a coffee maker as much of a gift, and there isn't much about automation he's likely to even want to think about. But no, you're not doomed to one more trip to the necktie store. Let's play Dad Think. And remember, electronic stores and hardware stores are to a man what chocolate shops and shoe stores are to a woman. So let's play on that. No man has enough LED flashlights. Decide on your gift-giving budget and hit the stores or the shopping sites hard. You can find choices that fit what he needs or thinks he needs. No man has enough power tools. And if your dad's power tools are getting pretty old, he might appreciate some of the newer stuff, especially the battery-powered but full-powered tools. Think carefully about what he uses at the grill. Does he need a good grilling thermometer, a powered grill scrubber, a grilling light? Dads love that stuff. Get him some high-count boxes of the batteries he uses most, AA, AAA, CD, 9-square, whatever. It's one less thing to run out of before he knows he's low. I don't know if this is true of your dad, but I'm kind of fond of the stations I can get on internet radio. So getting him one of those might be something he likes, even better if you can make it look like it was never out of the box but still loaded full of stations he's likely to like. Dads like optics. Which ones? Depend on his nature, but binoculars, telescopes, magnifiers, and other things in that realm could be cool. Some dads are closet naturalists. Bird feeders or bird houses or books that help identify local birds or that use bark and leaves to identify trees. Does that sound like something your dad would like? Sports fan? Caps or pennants are cool. Fisherman? Mosquito repellent. Does he still use an analog phone? Get him a new one. An alarm clock or clock radio? Ditto. Something else. Dads are hoarders. And while they may not be proud of it, their collections are something they may unreasonably perceive as a source of pride. Since you can't take them away, help Dad hide them away. Toolboxes, ammo boxes, wine crates, library card files, any kind of interesting little box starts as an empty thing and can turn into his treasure chest. But okay, you want me to get closer to the kinds of things my cybernetic house does to pamper the kind of lazy cheapskate whose lifestyle it so nicely supports, so let's go there. Workbenches never have enough outlets. Get him a power strip, the kind that's several feet long, ideally with surge protection. Get him some of those little lights that plug into empty outlets and light up when somebody walks by at night. Get him a little weather gizmo, maybe indoor-outdoor, maybe with a clock, maybe with a forecast on the screen. Get him an outdoor clock for the patio, maybe with the temperature on it. Get him a proximity parking assist gizmo for the garage. Get him a plug-in rechargeable light that turns on automatically when the power fails. Get him a loud pocket whistle, just blowing it, not electronic, just a loud pocket whistle so he can signal for help no matter what. Get him a fancy pencil cup and fill it with gizmos in addition to pens or pencils, little screwdrivers, pen lights, short rulers, that kind of thing. Get him a little thin label printer. My cybernetic house takes about 2,000 temperature readings. So, you know, why not? Get Dad a collection of half a dozen to a dozen small thermometers he can hang on the walls of most of the rooms. I have 30-plus video surveillance cameras all on power over Ethernet, PoE, but you can get him one on Wi-Fi. I know when somebody opens the mailbox, he can hang a small but loud bell on his. Really, though, the gifts are tokens of how you feel. You want to choose a token he'll use often with a nice thought about you to go with it each time. He'll be happy with anything you give him unless you plan on something mean, in which case, I don't want to hear about it. But you don't have to buy him a new car or a trip to exotic lands. He's just Dad. He probably has more coffee cups and adult beverage glasses than anybody can handle. But he'll be gracious if you decide he'll really love to get just one more. He's older than you know. So whether you do or not, he might like the idea of getting an interesting book. Try to sense his interests. If he's not a handy guy, you may want to get him a book about how to repair almost anything with duct tape and a Swiss Army knife. But he might really enjoy one of those big, colorfully illustrated books that explains how things work. Don't try to be overly cute or clever. If you think, as a boy, he might have played with Erector sets or ViewMaster 3D viewers or wind-up robots, getting him one will be, at most, a brief novelty and, more likely, something he'll either give away or stick into storage. And don't think short-term. If he loves to grill, getting him a box of steaks means giving him a gift that, if you think about it, well, the more he likes it, the sooner it'll disappear. And with that last bite, there goes the last tangible memory of that gift. Speaking of memories, I wouldn't remember half of what I just talked about, so here's a fast recap of the ideas I brought up. Boxes, books, thermometers, Wi-Fi surveillance camera, pencil cup with items you add, rechargeable power failure light, proximity parking assist, outdoor patio clock, indoor-outdoor weather gizmos, sensor-triggered nightlight, long power strip, preferably with a surge protector, empty storage boxes, replacement analog phone, mosquito repellent, sports cap or pennants, bird feeders or houses, bird or tree books, binoculars or other optics, an internet radio, a supply of replacement batteries, power grill scrubber, grilling thermometer, a power tool, an LED flashlight. That's the list. Happy Father's Day to him and to you. Oh, and if he has a computer, something to help him back up, back up, back up.
Thank you, Marty.
I know what I want for Father's Day. My grandchildren asked me the other day what I wanted, and I simply told them, all I want is a big hug and kiss.
Public service announcements. Schedule computer club meetings in the tri-state northeastern region. The New York Amateur Computer Club will have a presentation on Excel versus Google Sheets Thursday, June 14th, 2018. Meeting time is 7 p.m. Meets at NYU Silver Building, room 405, that's 405, in Manhattan, New York. Princeton PC Users Group will have a presentation on What's a Router and Why Do We Want One? Tuesday, June 26, 2018, meeting time is 7 p.m. at Mercer County Library, Lawrenceville, New Jersey. Brookdale Computer Users Group will actually have the same presentation as the Princeton PC Users Group, What's a Router and Why Do We Want One? Thursday, June 28, 2018, meeting time is 6:45 p.m., and they'll meet at the Middletown Library Large Meeting Room at 55 New Monmouth Road, Middletown, New Jersey. Danbury Area Computer Society has a meeting scheduled for July 3, 2018. Meeting time is 7:30 p.m., and they'll meet at the Danbury Hospital Auditorium in Danbury, Connecticut. Westchester PC Users Group will have a presentation on The Secret History of Silicon Valley, Thursday, July 5, 2018, meeting time is 7 p.m., at the Keller Williams Realty, located at 120 Bloomingdale Road, first floor, White Plains, New York. Long Island Macintosh Users Group will be meeting July 13th, meeting time is 7 p.m. They'll meet at the New York Institute of Technology at Old Westbury Campus, located on Northern Boulevard and Valentine's Lane, and they'll be meeting in the auditorium of the Harry J. Scherr Hall. The Amateur Computer Group of New Jersey will have a hiatus of meetings in July and August. They'll be reconvening a meeting Friday, September the 7th at 8 p.m., Scotch Plains Rescue Squad at 1916 Bartle Avenue in Scotch Plains, New Jersey. All these computer club meetings are free and open to the public. We hope to see you at the meeting. And if you have never been to a computer meeting, this is a good time to go if you have any questions on any computer products or how to do something. And just remember, there's no such thing as a dumb question in computing. Our website is pcradioshow.org. We can be heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on prn.fm on the internet and at 9 p.m. Eastern Time on BAI FM 99.5 New York on the radio or WBAI.org, streaming on the internet. In the meantime, stay in touch and keep on computing. And remember, backup, backup, and backup. Be vigilant. Do you know who has your personal data? Let me ask the question differently. Do you know who's using your personal data? If you have any questions, you can send mail to me. That's Hank at PCRadioshow.org. I'm Hank Key, and on behalf of Joe King and Michael Horowitz, we thank you for listening. And remember, next week, it's the start of summer. So stay safe and healthy, and till we meet again, same time, same station next week.